calls another customer. We see the banker sitting waiting for a trim.
Back. Do I have my folks?
I'm here.
Gail?
And I'm here.
Yay!
And I'm here.
Oh,
it's
hooray. College radio at its finest. I apologize to all three of you and the listeners for that terrible radio snafu.
Conference calling is always a gamble.
It is. It's tough getting three folks on the phone together. And I may ask one person to talk quieter than the other because I can't separate into channels. All I have is everyone on one line.
Oh man,
it's
so you mean I can't talk over Jeet?
If you yelled, you could.
So you talked over me. So.
In fact, I think in this situation, you can talk over someone else with much ease because I can't turn you off.
I see. Okay.
So I'm going to reintroduce my guests. Let's just start with a clean slate. Inkstud, CITR 101.9 FM. Today, we're specifically talking about John Stanley. We've had some technical issues for the last 15 minutes, and now we sound like we are all set. So I'm joined by Jeet here. Our regular listeners will be very familiar with him. Frank Young, who does the Stanley Stories blog, which we'll get into a little later. Jeet came with the position editor. I'm still more slightly towards archivist. And lastly, but not least, Gail Singer. Now, you're a documentary filmmaker, Gail?
Yes. One of the things I do.
One of the things. You do other things, many things?
Many things.
Many things.
Yeah. The show's not long enough.
All right. Now, Jeet wanted to bring you on. I guess I'll let Jeet.
Well, you want to jump in here?
We're
talking today about John Stanley, who's an American cartoonist from the middle of the last century, and he did many things, but these days he's best remembered as the writer and maybe the auteur, in some ways, of the Little Lulu series, the comic book series that ran starting in 1945, and ran for many decades, Stanley working on it, until roughly the late, the end of the 1950s. The character Little Lulu was created by another very interesting cartoonist, which we'll discuss a little bit later, Marjorie Henderson Buell. And Stanley was a real sort of journeyman cartoonist who worked with other people's characters, sort of like Carl Barks, who did the Uncle Scrooge stories. I think one reason that the Little Lulu stories have been so fondly remembered and continue to be talked about is that they're interestingly sort of proto-feminist, and maybe this is a good reason to bring Gail in, because she grew up on some of these comics, and they, unlike a lot of comics from that era, which featured sort of subservient women, Lulu was very much her own girl. Maybe Gail wants to say something about that.
Sure, of course I do. Well, first of all, I actually think when Jean and I had talked about Little Lulu some long time ago, and when I thought about her, I actually wondered if she'd had a political, philosophical influence on me, because I was so attached to the character she was, because she was such a rare type in my childhood, this unconsciously tough cookie, really, who often was funnier and or smarter than her best friend, her best boyfriend, her best male friend, and she had a confidence about her and an assumption about where she sat or stood in the universe that was just a rarity in that era. And it's funny, because now when I read about her and, you know, there are descriptions about how she navigates the complex world of clubhouse bullies. I'm quoting that off the back of one of the compendiums of her work. That notion of her, any kind of deliberate independence and strength was just so out of the picture in my childhood, and when she was being created initially by Marjorie Buell, who I gather maintained for some time after Stanley took over what the character of Little Lulu would be like. So that, you know, I don't know, that may account, and Buell is a very interesting character herself, that may account for who Little Lulu was and remained. I think she's quite different in her... Stanley changed her character somewhat over the years and made...
Yeah, yeah. Yes,
he
did.
Anyway, I better let somebody else talk first.
Well, I was just thinking, Buell's version of Little Lulu was basically as a little imp, a mischief maker.
And, right, you're right.
And in the earliest of John Stanley's comics, he clings to that, but very quickly, by the end of the 40s, he has transformed her. I feel that he kind of took over those characters and reimagined them. And by around 1949 or 1950, you see Lulu emerging as this very self-confident, determined, aware, just, you know, a very powerful figure. And it's a female figure that appears again and again in Stanley's work.
Uh-huh.
It's a central figure of his storytelling interest, is this are complicated, confident female characters, whether they're villains or heroes, they all carry themselves with this absolute certainty.
It seems, just reading the work that I've been reading, he has respect for his characters.
Yeah, yes. I think that's right. I think one of the hallmarks of Stanley's work, especially the Lulu work, is the sort of range of characters he creates, and the way in which they have this sort of, like, integrity. I mean, Lulu's, we've talked a little bit about, and her big foil is Tubby, her male friend. And Tubby's, like, a fascinating character, because he's a sort of romantic egoist. He's always imagining himself as this great adventurer, as a detective, or as a hobo, and he sort of, like, tries to bend reality to his will. And this being a John Stanley comic, that doesn't always end up too well, but it's always kind of funny. And actually, I think that's one thing I should maybe foreground here, which is that these are, like, really funny comics. Like, these, you know, they were meant for kids and for the parents of kids, and they have this real wit to them. And a lot of the wit does come from the stuff we're talking about in terms of the characters and also maybe the wordplay. Like, there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of banter between Lulu and Tubby, and it often feels like a sort of screwball comedy in the sort of Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy vein, except that they're little kids.
Well, and I think what he also did so brilliantly that allows the humor to sit there and exist is that the world that little Lulu and Tubby and their friends live in is absolutely real. I mean, when I read it as a kid, I believed that world existed. I didn't think of it as a fairy tale. I didn't think of it as something made up. And the other thing that occurred to me is that my era with this was an era that was steep in Freudian analysis. And Freud was kind of present in the way of thinking about things. And I think that there's a very, very deep, but nonetheless present undercurrent of some Freudian stereotypical relationships in the original, well, not the very original, but the Stanley version of the of Little Lulu.
Yeah, I want to just take up Gail's point, because it's an excellent one. And I think for people who haven't read Little Lulu, one of the best places to start is the Toon Treasury of classic children's comics that Art Spiegelman and Francois Mouly edited.
And yourself and Frank were consulted.
Yeah, Frank and I were sort of consultants on that, so we have to confess that. But in that book, there's this wonderful story which takes up the theme of gender war in a very Freudian way, as Gail would indicate. It's called Five Little Babies, and it starts... It's this world of resentment. It's a sort of like schoolhouse world. It starts with the rich kid, Wilbur, sort of trying to humiliate the other regular fellers like Tubby and the boys. And then he convinces them that he can outsmart Lulu. And they don't believe it because no one can outsmart Lulu. And through trickery, he convinces Lulu to walk around like a dog. And, of course, Lulu, and especially her young female friend Annie, is like they're sort of very upset when they find out that Lulu's been conned. And then they, in turn, play a trick on the boys, which involves diapers and the little pins. And it all
open
has
safety
of,
pins.
Huh? Safety pins.
Open safety pins.
So the whole story, I mean, has this sort of classic screwball feel, but it also has this real, like, undercurrent of sort of like, tension about sexual identity, tension about masculinity and femininity, you know, the desire for to make others submit to your will. And I think this is something Frank has written quite well about, the sort of the psychological acunum of John Stanley.
And that's an aspect that maintains my fascination with his work. There's an undeniable darkness creeping around the edges of even the happiest of Little Lulu stories. He wrote, I feel, from a very dark place and somehow managed to, for the most part, synthesize that darkness into a very vibrant, very entertaining, and intelligently written comics. But he was quoted late in his life as saying, quote unquote, I don't believe in psychiatrists and pills. And he was an acknowledged sufferer of depression and never really treated it, from what I understand. And in a sense, some of these things that we see as Freudian may have been entirely unconscious on his part as a storyteller.
I would guess that you're right. I mean, they don't feel like they're laid on to what he's doing. They feel like they emerge from the culture that he lived in and perhaps his own circumstances.
Yeah, they start like bubbling up from the conscience. Yeah, yeah. But certainly, if he's not self-consciously Freudian, he does have a real interest in human psychology. And
very
in
much.
Sort of, you know, the sort of mild form of badness that all of us share. I mean, I really see that in sort of the Tubby character, who's kind of delusional, but functionally delusional.
Well, the other thing is that I was thinking about who would little Lulu have turned into, because she did feel like a real character to me, and curiously, I mean, I'm as surprised about this as you will be when I tell you that I think that she might have been a Barbara Emile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Conrad Black's loyal wife.
Huh.
Beautiful and confident and perfectly perfect cosmetic surgery and smart and, you know, from what people tell me, I don't know personally, but on top of the game.
Sure. Yeah. No, there's something to that. Although I have to say, I think maybe Lulu's a little bit smarter than Barbara Emile.
Well,
maybe the other way to put it is that Conrad Black, the Canadian newspaper tycoon who is currently in jail, is
Sir Conrad Black. Isn't it Sir Conrad Black?
Sir Conrad Black. Yeah. Yeah, there's something about Conrad that, I mean, now that Gail brought up the analogy, there's something about Conrad Black that is a little bit like Tubby. There's that sort of delusional aspect that I talked about. And then the romantic sort of aspect, you know? The wanting to be a lord.
I mean, it. I know it's far-fetched, but there's something about it that seems apropos. You know, the politics may not fit. I don't think little Lulu would turn into a right-wing conservative. I'll leave it at that.
There's something to what Gail has said.
She does seem like she. I do see her assuming some kind of a responsible authority position in the world as an adult. You know, maybe she was an environmental activist or something. You know, she just seems like she's destined to do something important with her life.
One thing I'm kind of noticing from the conversations you're having about the characters, my own observations reading the characters, which probably won't be as in depth as Jeets and Frank's, is it seems like he's kind of working with character archetypes in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's got a character and they kind of almost fit a mold, but he plays with that mold
very much. In my study of his work, I've identified there these three types of characters that he constantly turns to, and one is the Lulu type, which I sort of call the voice of reason.
The which, sorry?
In all of Stanley's work, he uses these three important characters. One is a character that little Lulu embodies, this voice of reason, this very rational, determined, straightforward character. And then you have what I call the Tubby type, which is the completely, wonderfully self-delusional person who is led by their cognitive biases and is as utterly confident of their own rightness. And then there is a character that is usually just there to raise the stakes, to be an obstacle to these two characters, or to threaten them in some way. And he seemed really drawn to these three types of characters, and basically all of the major and minor characters in all his comics can fit into these three categories.
Uh-huh. Well, you would certainly know better than I, but I had the sense that, I don't know how long she did this for, but that Marjorie Buell, in particular with little Lulu, kept a kind of, kept a sort of watchful eye over the changes that might ensue from Stanley taking over. And I, it's interesting what you say about she would have become a kind of, significant personage, because I think both Buell and I have always resisted the interference of the political in the kind of philosophical or the humor or the real life led. And that was one of the things that always appealed to me and continued to appeal to me about Little Lulu, is that she seemed to have a mind of her own.
Yes.
Wasn't swayed by the prevailing the mores, yes, because they were the mores of childhood, so they were relatively speaking innocent, but she didn't take up causes, it would seem to me. She looked after herself in a sense.
Well, she is at times an advocate for friends of hers, like her friend Annie, who is often depicted as, their family is often depicted as being on the edge of poverty.
Right.
She frequently advocates for Annie and
right.
And advocates for animals and smaller children. She gets a notion that somebody is being mistreated, and she acts rather righteously on that assumption.
I think you're right, but I always, at least in my reading of it, I always took it as something that it was something personal to her.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. It's not. Yeah, it really is on a case by case basis.
Exactly.
And it's an emotional reaction. I mean, she's addressing a specific incident, but she just thinks, this is not right. This is upsetting me. I've got to do something about it.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, looking at the time when John Stanley's creating this work, this kind of insight into character creation, it's pretty unusual, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Because of the time period?
In terms of the comic book world, I think the only other person that was doing anything comparable was Carl Barks with his sort of Duck comics.
I was kind of making my own little notes and stuff. I also kind of feel some parallels with Kurtzman in a way, too.
That's kind of interesting. I mean, they're both very strong cartoonists, but I mean, I think Kurtzman with Mad Magazine, he was more what Gail was talking about, sort of commenting on the larger social culture, the mm-hmm. political culture, with this anarchist sensibility, and then the same with the war books. I mean, Kurtzman was very interested in these large issues, of like war and of advertising, whereas I think Gail had a really keen insight that there's a sort of Stanley's concerned about the private world, you know, the world of human interaction, the relationship.
It's worth noting
people.
That his comics are almost completely devoid of topical references.
Mm-hmm.
Just consistently throughout his career, that it is mostly the issues of people and their flaws and quirks and virtues that really drives his storytelling.
Yeah. Well,
it's also interesting is that...
And I want to just follow up on that, because I think it's interesting that you can kind of read Lulu without really knowing when it's from. Like, it sort of has a sort of, like, timeless, you know, small town or, you know, small city sort of feel.
Yes.
It could be the 30s, it could be the 40s, it could be the 60s or 70s, you know? Like, there. I mean, I think kids today could, like, read a Little Lulu, and they'd be kind of hard-pressed to get a sense that it's like from a really distant period, because it doesn't have those sort of topical references.
It's funny, you know, I don't know if any of you would remember or have seen Ellen DeGeneres before she got her TV show and became who she is now, but she used to do stand-up.
Yes.
and her material had that same feeling to it. It was the details, the ordinary details of everyday life. And she turned it into extraordinary humor. I mean, it was her stuff
yes.
was hilarious.
Yes,
and there's a bit of that quality to what Stanley did with Little Lulu.
I think that's true. It's sometimes it's a case of just focusing on one odd little aspect of everyday life, and by calling attention to it, addressing the absurdity of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of his humor comes from that viewpoint. That's a really interesting comparison. I think it's valid.
I want to kind of put us in a different direction because we're probably about halfway point in our time coverage, and we've talked about Little Lulu, but that's only a part of who John Stanley was, if I'm not correct. So I kind of want to get a little bit more of an idea of who he was as a cartoonist as well, get into, because I mean right now we're seeing a resurgence in John Stanley material. We have the collections from Drawn and Quarterly, the 13 going on 18, the Melvin the Monster, and the Nancy strips he's doing as well. I also want to make a note that there are two John Stanley strips in the Art and Time book, which will be out, I guess, in a month or
something like that,
which are nothing like the other types of strips.
If you would forgive me, after enjoying myself thus far, if I left you to the rest of the conversation, because there's a little trauma in Toronto where I'm speaking from, because the internet is down.
The world will. Well, thank you so much for joining
us,
Gail.
I'm actually having a nervous breakdown, but I'm controlling myself.
Well, thank you.
I really enjoyed hearing your what you had to say. It was very interesting.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking with you, and I hope we do that again.
Me too.
Okay, I'm going to hang up. I hope it doesn't disrupt anything.
It'll be fine. Thanks,
okay,
Gail.
Thanks a million. Carry on.
So you were saying about John Stanley's larger career, and I think this is something maybe Frank can also speak about, but I mean, I think the basic... there's very little known about his early days, but he sort of, really came of age in the Depression, which must have been a formative experience. He worked, he did some, wanted to be a graphic designer. And, hello?
Okay, something did happen. Hold on. There we go. I got you, boys.
So I could just continue to sort of describe Stanley. He worked for the Max Fletcher Studios for a bit, and then he landed a job in the early 40s working for Dell, which was a sort of a comic book company that really was making itself the major force in kids' comics, especially licensed properties like Disney and Woody Woodpecker and many other characters. And then he really became a sort of journeyman artist there, mainly writer, but he also drew. And then later when he did Lulu, he would do the basic layouts, in that sense very similar to Harvey Kurtzman, having other artists do the finished art. But Frank, do you want to say anything more about the sort of, you know, Stanley's background as a cartoonist?
Well, I still got you there, Frank? Oh, we didn't lose Frank again.
Oh. Did you want to play some music?
Yeah, I'll play a quick track. Frank shouldn't have been gone. I don't know why that happened. So we'll be right back. Ink Studs, the radio show that never seems to work.
She's a fool, and don't I know it? But a fool can have her charms. I'm in love, and don't I show it? Like a babe in arms. Love's the same old sad sensation. Lately, I've not slept a wink since this half-pint imitation put me on the blink. Beguiled again, a simpering, whimpering child again, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. Couldn't sleep and wouldn't sleep. Love came and told me I shouldn't sleep. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. of it. She is cold, I agree. She can laugh, but I love it. Although the lie.
And we're back. Goodbye, Frank.
Here we are.
Hi, Jeet.
Hi.
It's you. Oh, I feel uncomfortable and awkward. Uneventful or over-eventful mishappening. So we're talking a bit about the background of John Stanley coming from the Depression, working for the Fleischers, very similar to Jack Kirby,
yes.
who also grew up in the Depression, and some of his first work was with the Fleischers. Just make it a note.
That's right. And then, like Kirby, he landed in the sort of burgeoning comic book industry and worked for Dell and was really sort of, you know, I keep using the word journeyman. Like, he really worked on licensed properties that yeah. Dell was putting out, like Woody Woodpecker, Andy Panda, and eventually Little Lulu. Does Frank, you want to, like, fill in more about sort of the arc of
Sure.
Stanley's career?
Actually, the first licensed character he worked on was Mickey Mouse.
Oh,
he worked on a Mickey Mouse magazine, which was Western's precursor to Walt Disney's comics and stories. I'm not sure exactly what he did. I have heard that he did some of the covers, which would make sense because he did a lot of comics covers throughout his career. And then towards the end of 1942, he did his first comics. His first published story that I'm aware of is a Tom and Jerry story. Mm-hmm. That appeared in January of 1943. And then later that year, he started doing some of the Walter Lantz features for a comic called New Funnies. Mm-hmm. And his earliest stories are kind of fascinating because even though he's still feeling his way around, you can see that he has an innate, he's just totally in touch with the comics medium and knows what to do with it. But he started with I think the first published comics art by him was that first issue of Little Lulu in 1945. In terms of, you know, sheer comic book stuff.
Sure, and I mean, just to give people a sense of the larger career, he continued to do Lulu, but it was also doing other licensed properties throughout the early 50s, and then I'm not quite sure, what's the end date for his work on Lulu? Is it like 59?
I know it's issue 135, which is late in 1959.
Okay, and then, but he's also doing work on things like Nancy, which he sort of turns into a kind of version of Little Lulu.
Yes.
And but then in the 60s, Dell sort of undergoes some changes, and he gets a chance to create his own characters, and that's the sort of period where he creates the teenage series 13 going on 18, which I think can best be described as what Betty and Veronica would be like if they were written by an intelligent writer.
Yes.
Hey.
But also he did this Duncan Liu, which is what Archie and Jughead would be like if they were written by an intelligent writer. He did Melvin Monster, which is a sort of, you know, take off on this sort of Addams Family idea, again, done with great verb
intelligence.
And various other series, including some ghost horror comics. Are those the ones that Dan O'Dell reprints in?
They're Tales of the Tomb from the Tombs.
Yes.
Number one.
Yeah. Which are very interesting. I mean, they're kind of genuinely scary, and that might tie in with something because, I mean, Lulu is a kind of humor comic, but there's always a sort of undercurrent of dread, especially in the sort of, you know, fairy tales that Lulu tells the neighborhood kid Elvis. And so I think in Stanley's
like
case, humor and horror
versions of Little Lulu's stories, they don't really work as traditional horror comics, but as a kind of a translation of nightmares and the subconscious to the comics page, they really succeed.
I'm really curious about them artistically, because they are so completely different from his other work, the horror stuff.
Yeah.
One of them was drawn by someone else, but the other one was drawn by him, if I'm right.
He didn't draw any of the horror
stuff.
It was drawn by a variety of staff artists. And one thing about them that may have really affected them was that the editor he was working with at the time, this cartoonist named L.B. Cole, really edited him with a heavy hand. And from what I've been able to discern, they didn't have a very harmonious relationship. And he fortunately left Dell. And the moment he leaves Dell is when Stanley starts drawing 13 going on 18. And I actually have recently been in touch with the person who was the editor after L.B. Cole. He just contacted me. He had seen Stanley stories. And he and I are going to do an interview sometime soon. I'm really excited because this is the first person I've encountered who's, like, still alive who worked with John Stanley.
Wow.
Yeah, that'll be fascinating, and I think the 1960 stuff is very interesting as well, because what Gail had mentioned earlier, that there's a sort of darkness in some of the stories, I think that really comes to the fore in some of the 60s work, especially sort of Melvin Monster, which is on the one hand a humorous kids comic, but I think can be seen also as an allegory for child abuse. I mean,
yes, it is a very dark. I always think of that novel by Linda Barry, Cruddy, when I'm reading Melvin Monster, because they're comparably bleak portraits of dysfunctional families and the darker side of, you know, the whole family structure.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I think Linda has actually cited Stanley's Lulu work as an inspiration. But I mean, also, I mean, they're beyond that, they're dealing with similar issues.
Yes.
But I mean, in Melvin Monster, you know, the little monster boy has a very loud, obnoxious, and sort of verbally abusive father called Baddy, which is, you know, bad daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And more interestingly, he has a mother figure who's wrapped up like in the Egyptian manner, who's called Mummy, and is sort of blind to what's going on around her. And I think that's the classic sort of abusive situation where one parent is very violent and the other parent is an enabler and doesn't see. So I think those comics are very interesting in that respect. And I think perhaps to just sort of wrap up our survey of his career, I mean, he did sort of leave the comics field, I guess, in the late 60s or early 70s with a certain degree of bitterness. And I think that's perhaps a difference with Carl Barks, who was a sort of, you know, happy company man and who easily was sort of absorbed by the world of fandom and started doing these paintings.
Yeah,
he got
a little grumpy. You know, his some of his last stories are rather crabby, and I know that he was a little worn out by the time, you know, he had been just churning out stories for a quarter of a century, and you know, I think he was ready to stop when he did, but he, as you said, he did embrace the all the love that was out there for him, whereas Stanley just turned his back on that. You know, he went to maybe one or two comics conventions in the mid-70s, and then he just shut the door on that until, like, the last couple of years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And there was definitely, you know, I would love to know the whole story. That's part of the fascination with him, is that you really, there's so little documented about his daily life.
You're kind of dealing with a Ditko type situation.
Yes. And, you know, I've talked with Stanley's son, Jim. I'm working on a book that I guess Drawn and Quartered will eventually publish called The Art of John Stanley. That is going to be a kind of coffee table book, just, you know, a critical view of his career with, you know, with several stories and excerpts from stories. And I'm looking forward to talking with Jim Stanley sometime soon, you know, again, just to get the sense of, you know, people that knew this guy and what he was really like as a person.
There is some sort of mystery there, but I mean, I think there's a lot that can kind of be gleaned from the stories. I mean, you do really get, you know, a sense of his wit and his intelligence, but also that sort of melancholy side. I mean, I don't think that it's an accident that Seth the Canadian cartoonist loves John Stanley, and I think in Seth's work you see a lot of the similar sort of sensibility, that sort of, you know, melancholy combined with wit.
Yes.
So I think that there's definitely a strong personality that comes through Stanley's comics.
Oh, go ahead, Frank.
They are, you know, it actually makes it possible to identify stories of his. I keep finding stories that you know, just tucked away in the back of some obscure Dell comic, that that presence of personality just really comes through. And it's fascinating how consistently he was able to assert his vision of the world via these, you know, quote-unquote kiddie comics.
Mm-hmm. Kind of that both of what you just said and what you just said kind of resonates. I'm just wondering the kind of the legacy that Stanley has left. I mean, you've commented on Seth. We should make a mention, I guess, of the Friends of Lulu.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, there's definitely a strong, I mean, as Gail sort of testified earlier, like, there's a strong tradition of women growing up and reading Lulu, and that, I mean, I think this is one reason actually why Stanley sort of fandom at large was slow to get to Lulu, in the sense that fandom is very male-oriented and was really into sort of, you know, EC and the superheroes, and the sort of things that are kids' comics and girl comics got less attention. But actually, I think one of the other big legacies of John Stanley, oddly enough, is Robert Crumb.
Yeah.
Know, who, if you read Crumb's letters from when he's a teenager, I mean, he was heavily into Lulu. And he still owns, you know, a huge run of, like, Lulu comics. And if you see, actually, I mean, if you look at the way Crumb organizes a page, the way he has characters that are just, like, walking around, his body language. I mean, that's all. It's John Stanley and Carl Barks. I mean, those
and
are
the writing as well. I mean, Crumb kind of adopted Stanley's use of the ellipse.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, the dot, dot, dot.
Mm-hmm.
He really uses that the same way that Stanley did, as a way of Stanley and Crumb, you know, all the great comics writers have been able to do this, is somehow through their writing, they sort of put a pacing and timing in there for the reader. They somehow control the flow of the story, and urge the reader to pause and consider certain things. And you know, it's remarkably good writing. I think it's genuinely literary.
We're nearing the end of our time,
mm-hmm.
so I have a really simple question for both of you. What's your favorite Stanley story? Or maybe it's not a simple question.
Well, I already
mentioned the story,
Five Little Babies, which is available in the Toon Treasury. That's a great Lulu story, and I think after that, it's not a story, but I think the series 13 going on 18 is Stanley's best work.
Frank?
And my single favorite story is in the Toon Treasury. It's a Tubby story called The Guest in the Ghost Hotel, which is a marvelous mixture of fantasy and reality. And overall, the comics of Stanley's that I tend to like the best are the ones that he also drew.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some difficulty getting 13 going on 18 for a while, but I've found myself getting into it and really admiring the great beauty and subtlety and the room that he gives those characters. It's you know, as we said earlier, he's so respectful of his characters.
He really,
I think that flowered in 13 going on 18, because you see them. You know, he depicts them at their lowest and their highest points, at their most vulnerable as well as their most confident, and it just takes a great deal of, I think, care and sincerity to be able to put fictional characters through those paces and still keep them, you know, just keeping them real and keeping them very much alive.
Well, the really neat thing about looking at the 13 going on 18 collection is you see the rough early days, which were illustrated by someone else, and then you kind of see, as Stanley gets more and more comfortable with the characters, and about four or five issues in, it's hit its pace and starts going.
Yeah, I think that title of all of Stanley's work gives you the most insight into his creative process, because you see him starting a series from scratch and just over, you know, the comic was published quarterly, so it's like over a couple of years' time, he figures out what to do with these characters and what their potential is, and you know, how he can use them for his typical narrative path in which an event, an escalating series of events, keeps raising the stakes. And, you know, by the end of the second year of that, he's just, you know, completely embodying those characters. It's as I said, it's a truly literary quality that writing has.
I think that's a good point to end it on.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you both so much for taking the time. Once again, I apologize for our...
No, it's okay. I thought it was a really great conversation.
It was.
I thought so, too. I've had a great time.
Well, thank you both. You're fine workers in spreading the good word of comics.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Frank.
Okay.
Have a good day, guys.
Bye.
You too. Bye. Just so folks know what to check out, there are the John Stanley Library from Drawn Quarterly, as well as the Lululu collections from Dark Horse Books, and mentioned briefly Art and Time, which will be out in about a month and a half, and I will have Dan Nadel on to discuss that collection. Next week, I think I'm going to have Graham Annabelle on to yak about Grickle, the big book of Grickle. All right. And I'm going to play an Ink Studs mixtape by Farrell Dalrymple next. And then at 3:30, we will have La Francais Connection. La Connection Francais. I don't know. I'm terrible on my French. Bye-bye.